This evening we'll be talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus Epiphanes, however you want to pronounce it. And he is one of the people that had a major impact on the Jewish nation and also on the world in general. That was obviously something done very selfishly for his own purposes and based upon his own ego and his own rage and his own desire for power. But God used an evil man to bring about his will. And God can use evil men as well as good men, and evil women and good women to bring about his will, because oftentimes we see things that appear to us to be very bad, to be very destructive. But God can use all those things for his purpose then, and he can use them for his purposes now. So what I'd like to do is get a kind of a running start into where we're going to be talking about tonight. So, on Sunday, what did you guys talk about? What were the major themes that kind of came out on Sunday? Because that kind of brings us into today's lesson about Mr. Epiphanes. What were some of the major
themes? The end of the Persian Empire.
Okay.
And then the breakup of, what the death of Alexander, and then the breakup of the Grecian Empire.
Okay. So you have the Persian Empire falling down. You have Alexander rising up. But then, how long did Alexander stay around?
Died in,
probably died in his early 30s, right? 30, 33, 35. And so Alexander doesn't stay around long. So after he conquers all these different areas across that the known world at that point in time, what happens to all those kingdoms that he had conquered?
It's divided up.
Okay, it's divided up. And among whom is it divided? Okay, four of his generals. Okay, and what were those generals' names? Don't look down.
Cassander.
Lysimachus.
Ptolemy.
And Seleucus.
Okay. All right, so, and how did they kind of settle out in terms of the territory they covered? How about Lysimachus? What did he control?
Macedonia.
Okay. Okay, and Asia Minor. Okay. What about Cassander? Macedonian Greeks, okay. So those two guys really didn't have a lot of run-ins or a lot of things to do with the Jewish nation. But who were the two guys, the other two guys, what territory did they have?
Egypt.
Egypt, and who was Egypt?
Ptolemy.
The Ptolemies, okay. And who was, who had the other territories that would impact the Jewish nation directly? The Seleucids, okay. So, as you look at the world map, you see the Seleucids had kind of Syria and over to the east, and then the Ptolemies had Egypt and up through Palestine. So when those guys began to war with one another, who was caught in the middle? Israel. So they would come by on their way to Egypt, or from Egypt on the way to Syria, and they would beat up on the Jews on their way through. So, some interesting things about the Ptolemies. What do we see that the Ptolemies did to bring about something that was very important for the spread of the gospel? What did the Ptolemies do? Yes?
They imported a large number of the Jews.
Okay. Very important. And what else did the Ptolemies do that was extremely important? That's a very, very important point. What else did they do? What's that?
Sponsor the Septuagint translation.
Okay. I'm sorry, Joan, you had something?
Yeah, religious freedom.
Religious freedom, okay. And also, Cherry mentioned that they decided to have the Old Testament translated into Greek. Now, why would they do that? Why do you think they would do that? Do you think they just really thought that the law of Moses was really important and something the world really needed to have? Why? Why would they do that? Hellenization of the world. And also, what were they building in Alexandria?
A library.
A great library. So if you had a piece of literature that was well known across the world, and you wanted to make sure that the Greek language and culture and so forth was kind of pushed through the entire world, you would translate that great piece of literature into the Greek language. And so that, I don't think there was any idea on their part that this was a great book and it really should be part of the world vernacular, but it was a piece of literature that was well-established, and in order for the Greek language to be pushed further through the world, they took this great book and put it in the library there in Alexandria. So we see that those things going on. And also we see that the Septuagint is often used to be often quoted in the New Testament by some of the, obviously by our Lord and by some of the apostles. So we see that as something that's being done because of, not necessarily for the best of motives, but God's will is established. So we see these generals kind of fighting among each other. And so what eventually happens in terms of which ones of these generals kind of come to the fore in terms of their power with regard to Israel?
Well, eventually the Seleucids are the ones that took over.
Okay. So the Seleucids kind of knocked the Ptolemies out of Jerusalem. And so that takes us to introduction to our buddy tonight, Mr. Epiphanes. So here we are in lesson number 6. We're still in the book of Daniel, and we're introduced to this Antiochus Epiphanes fellow. And we'll talk about the Maccabees on Sunday. So just to give us a point of view of where we are, we're right here at the bend of this timeline in between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And we see that the Ptolemies kind of decrease and the Seleucids increase in their power. And we'll see on Sunday that the Hasmonean period came in as the Maccabees revolted against all the evil things that this Antiochus Epiphanes did. Danny, if you wouldn't mind reading that passage in Revelation chapter 13. And what I want you to think about is this is a description of persecution of God's people. And this description of persecution of God's people in Revelation is very, very similar to the one that we'll see in the book of Daniel.
The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head was a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear, and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and a great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had on it a fatal wound, but the wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast. People worshiped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast, and they also worshiped the beast and asked, who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it? How far down?
That's good. That's good.
10. Okay.
So that's fine. We can stop there. So you see in the book of Revelation the description of the persecution of the church by the people that were in charge at that point in time being Rome. But also you see a description of God's people being persecuted in Daniel that's very similar. You see the idea of having multiple heads and being enraged and fighting against the people of God and blasphemous words and so forth. And you'll also see in verse 5 it said he's allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. If you look in the book of Daniel, you'll see that this beast that's being described is allowed to exercise authority for 1,260 days. So you see both of those things being representative of persecution of God's people. And we'll talk a bit more about how that persecution arose, where it came from, and how it was escalated by Mr. Epiphanes. So here we are in Daniel's vision. The leopard and the goat that's being described, and the belly and the thighs of bronze, representing the Greek Empire, and then the two parts of it, obviously the beginning of it with Alexander, and then you see AE4, we'll give him that cute name, and then you see the Maccabean revolt that kind of ends those sort of things for the Jews. So what do we know about this Antiochus Epiphanes? Where did he come from?
Son of Antiochus Epiphanes III.
Okay. So he was the son of Antiochus Epiphanes III, and he was among the Seleucids as part of the power structure there among the Greeks. And he's spoken about in Daniel as well, and we'll read some of those verses. But what do we know about his motivation? What was he all about?
Power.
Okay, power. All right, very important.
The Greek Greek culture.
Greek culture, okay. Now, it seems like he is the one who kind of takes it beyond anything that's reasonable compared to some of the others, because obviously Alexander was very much involved in spreading Greek culture and Greek art and those sort of things. But Epiphanes seems to be the one who really takes it beyond the pale of anything that's reasonable. So what are some of the things that we see him doing? Or what is he called? What are some of his names that he's given?
Madman.
He's called the madman. What else?
Abomination.
Abomination, the desolation. What else? He's also referred to as the pork jammer, because he tried to jam pork down the throats of Jewish people as an affront to their religion.
The term madman is a play on words. Epiphanes, of course, means glorious, worshipful. Epimenes means madman. So, Epimenes, very close.
Right. So his name was very fitting. Okay, so we see him described as being a madman. And what did he do specifically against the Jewish religion? What sort of steps did he take?
Desecrating the temple with idols,
okay,
and offering pigs on the altar.
Okay, so he desecrated the temple by doing what?
Well, with the altars and the pigs.
Okay.
And making the Jewish law by God worship ineffective,
okay,
when you do all that, because you're supposed to enter the temple, nobody but the priest and so on.
Okay, so he brought the idol Zeus into the temple.
Mm-hmm.
He also offered a pig on the altar. And what else did he do in terms of the law itself? What sort of steps did he go to, extreme steps, to get people to, and he was a terrorist. He terrorized people. And he wanted people to be afraid of him and afraid of the Greek dominators because of what things he did. What else did he do?
He abolished, he forbade them to meet on the Sabbath. He forbade them to do circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
He insisted, as Jen said, he insisted not only that the pork be offered on the altar, but that they eat it.
Right.
And anything that was distinctive to Judaism, it seemed he immediately either tried to squash it or contravene it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So he made the practice of circumcision against the law. What did he do about God's law? What did he try to do with it? Limited how? It was illegal to have a copy of the Torah, and it was punishable by death. And so what did he do as a terroristic act against God's people to intimidate them into following the Greek culture? What sort of things would he do?
Burn the scrolls.
Okay. Destroy the law. What sort of violence would he do against an individual who was practicing Judaism?
Some were flogged to death. Some were thrown off of walls. Some were executed one at a time as they, members of the family, refused to go along with him. He'd just systematically go through them.
Mm-hmm. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
Yes.
Sounds really familiar. Sounds like the news from last week. What's that?
He was very cultured.
Yes.
Very civilized.
He was. And what he would do is, if he found someone who had circumcised a child, he would crucify that individual and hang the child around their neck while they're being crucified. Just to show, I'm in charge, you need to do what I say, or this is going to happen to the rest of you. So he was very violent, and he was very aggressive in his stance against the Jewish religion. Now, a couple other things that are kind of noteworthy about him. I'm sorry, there was another comment. I thought I heard somebody say something. Okay. So, he was very aggressive with all this, and he was very, very strong in that. And he wanted to wipe out anything that wasn't based on Greek culture and so forth. So, why was the Jewish religion particularly an affront to him?
Exclusive.
It was exclusive. Now, if the Jews would have said, hey, listen, we have this Jehovah, and he's very important to us, but if you want to bring Zeus in here, you want to bring Apollo in here, that's fine. But but, you know, Jehovah has to be the most important. But the problem was that the Jews knew there was only one God, and they were exclusive in that. And what got the Christians in trouble with the Roman Empire was that they were bad people.
Refusal to worship some other God.
Refusal to worship their gods. So the history didn't change much. You had an exclusive knowledge of one God and the true God that got the Jews at that point in time and the Christians in trouble with the government because they would not go along. They would not be tolerant. Now, does that sound like any place you live?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, it hasn't changed much, has it? What's the worst thing you can possibly do to somebody today? Tell them they're wrong. What do you mean I'm wrong? Defining truth and error, that's just an affront to people. So,
point where you can't sit in one God.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And you heard about the baseball team getting in trouble for, or a football player getting in trouble for praying. You know, he's just an outcast. He's an oddball. What's wrong with him, you know? So our culture is becoming very much like that. Now, Europe is pretty much ahead of us in terms of that sort of taking all thoughts of God and all thoughts of anything religious and all thoughts of right and wrong out, but we're not far behind. And as our country continues to go down this path, we'll have those same issues in the future. So, unfortunately, things have not changed a lot. So, Antiochus Epiphanes decides, I need to go down to conquer some more territory. And where does he decide to go? He decides to go to Egypt. Okay? Sound like a great plan. Egypt's always getting conquered. No big deal. So what happens when he goes down there?
A little tribe of Romans were down there.
Okay. So he goes down there and some fellers from Rome said,
go away.
I think you need to turn your forces back. And they had lots of ships that came up against him. And they're referred to as the ships of Kittim in Daniel's Revelation. So he decides to go take some territory. And the Romans say, no, you need to go back where you came from. So what does he do with that anger and that desire for territory and that desire to dominate people? He goes to Jerusalem.
Takes it out on the Israelites.
Now, what does that sound like to you? Anyone ever dealt with a bully at school? I'd have. I won't tell you what happened to me, but... what happens when a bully runs up against a bigger bully?
He kicks the cat.
They find someone they can pick on. And the Jews, guess where they happened to be when he was retreating from the Romans? Right on the way. Very convenient. So he does all these things and tries to, and goes after the Jews and tries to do all these things against them. So turn over to Daniel chapter 11, if you would, please. Marty, if you wouldn't mind reading verses 20 down through 23, please, of Daniel chapter 11 when you get there.
His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. He'll invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and the Prince of the Covenant will be destroyed. After coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power.
Okay.
Is that it?
That's good. So we see a couple. It's amazing how Daniel just guessed at these things. You know, it's just really amazing how that Daniel was able to just figure these things out years and years and years in advance of them. But what's going on here? We see these different characters being introduced here. We see this character who's going to get tribute. Then we see a contemptible person. Then we see someone going after the Prince of the Covenant. And then we have this person who gains their influence by intrigue. So who is that? Who's doing all this stuff? Okay. So not only was he bloodthirsty and vengeful and filled with rage, he also was able to establish some of his kingdom by bribing people, by giving gifts to the right people, by bringing friends to his side, by exacting tribute. So not everything he did was based on violence. Some of the things he did was based on intrigue and so forth. So then we see, if we begin in verse 24 and read down through 28, if you wouldn't mind, Brother Ken Morrison, reading that for us.
In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against the strongholds, but only for a time. He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army, so the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war. But he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. Those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. And then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land.
Okay. So we see several things going on here. We see him going forth into battle, and he's going against this king of the south. Who would this king of the south represent?
The Ptolemies.
Okay. So we see him going against basically his countrymen, the Greeks. But who does he bring along with him in this force? What kind of army does he have? Powerful army.
Yeah. Mercenaries.
They're mercenaries. And what's the problem with having a mercenary armed force?
Someone else pays them more, they'll fight for them.
Mm-hmm. Someone else decides to give them more riches or more plunder or whatever else, they go to their side. Or...
And their loyalty is only as deep as their benefit.
Right. And they figure, hey, this is a tough battle. I didn't sign up for this. I'm leaving. So a lot of people deserted from the king of the south. So that's one of the reasons why he was able to overtake them. And it does seem, though, that for a period of time, he was able to have a lot of great victories and take a lot of land and those sort of things. So why do you think... Why do you think history worked out that way for him? Why do you think he was allowed to do all these things? I mean, he's obviously a monster, obviously evil. Why was he allowed to do these things? Who was orchestrating this whole thing?
God.
God was. And what was God doing through him?
Restricting his people.
Okay. Strengthening his people. What else? What else do you think God was trying to accomplish through this monster?
Well, it would really sort out those that were faithful to God and those that weren't.
Mm-hmm. It was a cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if persecution comes, who are the first ones to jump off?
Those that are not strong in their faith.
Mercenaries.
Those who are not strong in their faith. Mm-hmm. Those who have not... had a firmly established root in their faith. Those are the first ones to jump off. So oftentimes God has had a cleansing of his people and a trying of his people by fire to bring out those who really were true to him and those who really were willing to go through the fire with him. Now, what's interesting is that as he goes through and collects this wealth and goes after the Egyptians and so forth, why do you think that God had the Romans turn him back from conquering Egypt? Just speculation. I don't want to whittle on God's end of the stick, but just some things that worked out for the kingdom's good by not having Egypt overrun by this madman.
Yeah.
Oh, they were able to maintain some independence later on and provide refuge for Jesus and his family. Later on, because they were not under the same influence. I mean, it wasn't friendly to the Jewish state by any means, but they weren't as antagonistic, and Herod couldn't move in that area.
Mm-hmm. Very important. And that's extremely important because that's where God's sons fled from another monster. So Egypt was very important. Also, what did we just talk about was being put together years earlier in Alexandria, Egypt?
Library.
With God's law. So if God's people were under persecution and the temple happened to be destroyed, which it was, where could they go get a copy of the law? So God was working all these things out in my mind, and obviously there's some conjecture there, but putting these things together, looking backward, we see God's hand in some of these things. And it's very interesting that oftentimes things that look really, really terrible to us at the time, it's only because we don't have enough information about it. One of the stories that Russ used to always tell about was he was with a business and they had a pretty significant loss in one of their properties. And everyone said, oh, this is awful. Oh, this is terrible. So, you know, he said, wait a minute. Let's think about this. What good might come out of this delay in this project? And as it turned out, the delay in the project worked out to be a really good thing because there are some market dynamics that worked out later that wouldn't have been in place when it happened earlier. So sometimes things that seem to be terrible to us, if we, you know, obviously we have faith in God that he'll work those things out, they work out for our good in the future. And that's where faith comes in, because we can't see what God can see. And we can't see how that this current distress is going to work out for the will of God later. It may not work in our lifetime, it may not work out in our children's lifetime, but God sees the beginning from the end from the beginning, and we have to have faith in him to do that. I think that's really a great faith builder for me as I look at these things and look at the accuracy of Daniel's prophecy of all these things and how history lines up exactly with what Daniel said many years before. Any comments, questions? I think it's just amazing that when you look at this, and that's why Daniel is probably one of the most attacked books in the Bible, because people said there's no way he could possibly have known those things. It had to be written later on. There's no way he could figure all these things out and all the intrigue and all the, you know, fighting among the kings and those sort of things. So that's a great faith builder for me. So we see him not only attacking Jews and the law and so forth. He goes at the very center of Jewish life, which is the temple. And he takes unclean animals, and he takes idols into the temple, and he takes all these other things that would be an affront to the Jews because of their devotion to Jehovah. Now, if you read earlier in history, if you read the book of Ezekiel, what was he saying about idolatry among the people? And what was he saying about their hearts? What did we see during that period of time? Before, obviously, they came back.
They carried it into the temple themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. And some of the priests were actually involved in sacrificing to these idols and then going to the temple with the blood on their garments, still from sacrificing to these idols, and then sacrificing in God's temple. So I think one of the things that really God brought about by this monster was to show them that you guys have left idolatry behind, and you have to be different, and you have to be a separate people from the rest of the world, and they were never going back to that. So I think he, by his violence and by his opposition to God's word and his complete disrespect for Jehovah God, really steeled the people to do the things that we'll see on Sunday with the Maccabean Revolt. Go ahead.
See, sometimes you get accustomed to things and you take them for granted. And so I think in Malachi you see that the people were taking the worship for granted, the sacrifice for granted. But then suddenly someone comes up and starts attacking those things, and it looks like you're going to lose them.
Right.
And all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, this is important to me. This is precious to me. Mm-hmm. And it makes you recognize the value of it. And so you're more willing to fight to hold on to it than you might have been if you just kept going on your casual accepting way.
And, you know, how many of you guys had siblings or have siblings? Okay. How many of you ever criticized your sibling?
Yeah.
Okay. That's okay. But what about someone else starts attacking your sibling? That's a different matter, right? No, you don't talk about my sister. You don't talk about my brother like that. I may talk about him like that. But that's what Epiphanes is really doing. He is making an affront against not only human beings, but obviously Jehovah God. And that really steeled the people to do the stuff that we're going to talk about on Sunday. So, a couple things I'd like to ask you guys to think about. What were the benefits that were derived for the people of God eventually from his madness? And we'll talk about some of those on Sunday, but what are some of the things that came out of it?
When you see people who are being put to death in cruel ways, it makes you appreciate the cause for which they're dying even more.
Mm-hmm.
And makes you recognize how valuable it is if they're willing to put their lives on the line in such painful ways to preserve that.
Right. I mean, even to an outsider looking in, there's got to be something to this. There's got to be something meaningful and deep and valuable to this if they're willing to go through all this and be, and even to die for it. And I think that's very, a very good thing that will lead to some of the stuff we'll talk about on Sunday. Very good. What else? What
well,
else would come of this?
At least for a short period of time, they gain their freedom.
Okay. All right. So he kind of was the catalyst, really kind of the camel, the straw that broke the camel's back to get them to finally throw off some of these guys for a period of time. And that, there's a benefit that came from that we'll talk about on Sunday. What else do you think? What other good came from this?
Sort of put in dark contrast the cultures, because I mean Hellenism was an issue. They were absorbing it. They were becoming part of that Hellenism.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be sort of to go from just sort of being in the flow versus kind of swimming along versus making you drink all of it.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes it takes something extreme to wake you up. And we've had some of those things lately in the news, right? Some things that we thought were just, you know, they're not really too much to be concerned about. And then we see people being beheaded by evil people. And it kind of woke everybody up. And we see the contrast between evil that's being perpetrated by people and people that are trying to do things that are good for folks. What else do you think was a value for this, these things that he did?
So later, this is, I mean, in some ways a pattern for the prophetic language for what the Christians would endure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of similar language and similar phenomena. I think Hebrews 11 maybe just makes, in some ways, makes a reference to this period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an encouragement to the Christian, Hebrew Christians,
right,
to be heroic in the same way, not rebelling like the Maccabees, but
mm-hmm.
you know, enduring.
And I think another thing, and I think that's really a valuable point as well. I think another thing too is this shows that God can bring his people through anything. God understands. God knows. God has things under control. There may be some things we don't understand. There may be some things that are confusing to us. But God understands. God knows. And God knows how to deliver his people. Now, oftentimes God will punish his people by the agency of evil men, but God knows how to deliver his people. I think that's another message of encouragement that Daniel gave to the people. In a prophetic way, and also in Revelation, we see that same information being given to the Christians so they can understand that, yes, Rome has power. There will be persecution. There will be things that are going to be bad that happen to people. People may lose their lives, but their soul will be saved, but they may lose their life. And God can bring his people through that. Brother Hall, you got something?
As you said, we're going to see Sunday the resistance to this, but there were some who went along with it. The priests, some of the priests, even opened the door for Antiochus to come into Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And when there is a conflict between error and the truth, and between right and wrong, they're really always going to be those who are going to compromise. And in some instances, try to make peace between these things. Mm-hmm. There was a Jewish philosopher down in Alexandria, mm-hmm, who thought that somehow he could unite Greek philosophy with the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. His name was Philo. Mm-hmm. And he had quite a lot of influence. But what he had to do was to water down the Old Testament law and to say that much of it didn't really mean what it said. It just meant something else totally,
right,
that would fit with Greek philosophy. Mm-hmm. And so he was a modernist, what we would call a modernist, mm-hmm, who really denied the real meaning of the Old Testament, so he could try to make harmony between it and Greek philosophy. And of course, there are people today doing the same kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Watering down the teaching of the scriptures to try to fit with modern science philosophy. Mm-hmm. Not anything modern that science can prove, but mm-hmm, philosophy.
Absolutely.
Or with various other philosophies that are contrary to the teachings of, mm-hmm, the scriptures.
And I don't know if you guys have ever seen these, but the bumper sticker that says coexist.
Yeah.
Now, what all do you have on those letters? You have the Star of David. Mm-hmm. You have the crescent from Islam.
You got a cross.
You have a cross. You have the yin and yang. And that's exactly the idea, that there's no real right or wrong. It's all just kind of what works best for you. And that if there's something in one set of moral laws you don't like, you just pick another one. And that's a great temptation for us as well, because compromise is always going to be there. The opportunity to do that is always going to be there. And that's the easy path to follow. But as Christians, we have to understand that compromise with any kind of error or watering down in any way God's word is an affront to God, because that's blasphemy. You're saying that God's word is not sufficient and we need something more or something less. And then we're saying that God, his message to us is not sufficient. Yes, you have a point?
Yeah, I don't know if this is a stretch at all, but I think it kind of proves that there can be good that comes out of really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So the Samaritans were one of those who went along, mm-hmm, with what was going on. They completely denounced the faith, and that kind of explains why there was such hostility between, mm-hmm, the two. But there's teachings of Jesus that comes out of this. Where do we worship? And he kind of goes into, expands on that. A lot of Jesus' teachings come from a lot of traditions that came out of this. And so it's certainly a lot of bad happens, but all the good messages.
No, I don't think that's a stretch at all, because obviously there was a Samaritan said, you know, this is how you worship. And they started their entire religion was based upon compromise. Don't go down to Dan and Bethel. It's too far for you. Just stay here, you know. We'll get some priests in here. We'll get our own temple. We'll get our own sacrifices. It's too much for you to go down there to Jerusalem. So it came from compromise, and obviously it went further and further apart. And as you see, the Samaritan woman said, hey, you know, what's right here? And Jesus had the opportunity to say, this is right, this is wrong. And there's a time coming where it won't matter if it's there or it's here. It's worshiping in truth, spirit and truth. Very good point. A lot of good things came from that. Okay? Now, I have an assignment for you tomorrow, for Sunday morning. What I want you to do is figure out something that came out of the conversion from the Greeks to the Romans, which we'll talk about later, that was essential to God's plan for salvation. Okay? Something that came out of the transition from the Greeks to the Romans that was essential to God's plan of salvation. That's your assignment for Sunday morning. Now, on Sunday morning, Lord willing, we'll be talking about the Maccabees. And the Maccabees are a very interesting group of people, and if you happen to have access to a Catholic Bible, or you want to go on the internet, you can read the book of Maccabees between now and Sunday. However, I wouldn't recommend it, because it's apocryphal literature, it's not inspired, there's probably lots of errors, there's probably lots of exaggeration, those kind of things, so I wouldn't recommend it, but it's kind of an interesting background if you want to read some of the things that are in those books of Maccabees that's actually in the Catholic Bible. And another thing I'll warn you about in the when you study the Maccabees is that there's a lot of things that are assumed to be miraculous that happened in this period that I'm not sure we can really say were truly miraculous things that happened. So I'll warn you about that for Sunday morning. Any questions or other comments you want to make before we wrap up for this evening? Yes, sir, Brother Ronnie.
And then, this is a good question, but something's come to my mind.
Yes, sir.
In my effort to understand all this, which I'm way down here, I'm going to be with you real quick. Do you think the Jews started understanding? Did they see these prophecies? Did they see them with the whole? I mean, they understood their history just like we understand our history in this country back 300 years.
I think there may have been some understanding of. They could see some of the history that had unfolded, and I think there was some understanding of that. I think the main thing they probably would have gotten from it is that no matter what the persecution is, God will bring us out of this. And I think that's the main message. And then I think you had a quick pointer.
I just had a question for you to repeat your question.
Okay, the question was, what was very important or critical in the change from the Greeks to the Romans for God's plan of salvation to be complete? What changed?